again, everyone. It's here. It's finally upon us. Friday, August 9th, 2019. I am Derek Hunter. I am your host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Please keep spreading the word. I love it when that happens. And I love getting emails from you guys. Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com is how to do that. Even when they're nasty and full of complaints, just lets me know that people are listening. I know I see numbers every once in a while now, and they're great numbers, but they're just numbers. You're real people. When you email me, it lets me know. It tells me what's going on as my cat is attacking a leaf. I don't know how the hell a leaf got into the basement. Anyway, welcome to the show. We've got the interview edition of the Daily Caller podcast. Today's interview was recorded a week ago with Liz Wheeler, One America News, about her new book, Tipping Points. And we have a couple of signed copies. At the end of the interview, you'll learn how to, you know how to enter probably, or you can just fast forward. Don't fast forward. You don't want to miss anything. The interview is about a half an hour long, so we get to spend a half an hour together as we get ready for the weekend. And my God, there is so damn much stupidity going on in this world. It is out of control. It's really just insane. You look at a day, a week like this, and you think, what in the hell is wrong with people? We had all the audio from MSNBC, all the insanity, all the stupidity. Every Democrat running for president thinks that a great strategy is to call half the country racist and hope that the other half of the country believes it and is so afraid that they show up to vote for you. That's unstable. That is something that needs medication. That is not an election strategy. But when you really have nothing else except for the policy ideas you're trying to sell, and your policy ideas are crazy and wildly unpopular, you go with what you got. Campaigns always go with their best idea. And if any of those, 48 candidates, 317 candidates, if any of those candidates really had something that they thought the American people were chomping at the bit for, please, this is what we need. Give us what we need. Well, they'd offer it, but they aren't offering it. We'll get into Joe Biden being a complete and total gaffe machine. Oh, my God. He's going to implode before Iowa. He's not going to make it to Iowa again. We have some unbelievable audio on that front. Saying he's old doesn't do it complete justice. He's got some problems. So we got that and the Liz Wheeler interview coming up. But first, I got to tell you about our great sponsor. And thanks to all of you who have been emailing me about Life Change Tea that you're on board. They're on board for a month. They're giving it a shot. They're testing out this little upstart podcast. And it's because of you that they're giving it a shot. Hopefully, it's because of you that they stick around. We shall see. Fingers crossed. Life Change Tea is a game changer. Look, I've been drinking it. I had a big jug of it up in the refrigerator. It's iced tea. You drink it iced tea. You brew it all up at once. Or you brew a gallon of it up at once. One bag. You get a bunch of bags, but you get one bag. You brew up a gallon of it, and you drink it. And boy, howdy, I'm feeling a lot better. Got more energy, got more pep. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice or not, because I can't really get too much louder because the wife and one of the kids are sleeping directly above me. So how does it work, this Life Change Tea that I'm talking about? Well, it's a proprietary herbal formula. It's called a gentle daily cleanse designed to rid your body of harmful intruders. And your body is coated on the way out with harmful intruders that you want to sort of clean that out. And then it keeps you cleaned out. It is amazing. Let's face it, our food was different a long time ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. It wasn't this processed crap. It was free of pesticides. It was nourishing and healthy for our bodies. Today, significantly less so. Pesticides, GMOs, herbicides, heavy, heavy, heavy processing. They've depleted the nutrition. They've taken it out of our food. They've washed it out of our food. It's no wonder we feel so run down all the time. Look, try it for yourself. Don't take my word for it, but try it based on my word. Go to getthetea.com now. That's getthetea, all one word, .com. Get ready for more energy. I drink it every day. Life Change Tea isn't available in stores and has a special bonus for you guys. For you. Just for you. And this is awesome. You get free shipping if you enter the promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K, and check out. You can't beat it. Give it a shot. You'll thank me for it. You'll feel better. Your body will thank you for it. And everybody around you will thank you for it. All right, lifechangetea.com. Thanks to them. Always appreciate the sponsors that we've had. We've had hit and runs. These guys are giving us a run. These guys aren't, you know, they're really taking a chance on us. And I appreciate the hell out of that. All righty, Joe Biden. Joe. You know, before we start about Joe Biden, there's just one story that is way out of what we usually talk about on this show, but I just saw it, and it boggles my freaking mind. This is from CNBC. Uber shares slide after reporting disappointing quarterly results. Uber is worth tens of billions of dollars, yet they haven't made 10 cents yet. And you just listen to these numbers. It's staggering. Uber shares dropped as much as 12% after the company delivered disappointing second quarter results on Thursday before settling down about 4%. So somehow these numbers, it loses 12% and then it gains back 8 of those percent. I had to do quick math. It's late. I'm tired. It was a miss on both top and bottom lines for Uber. Net losses for the ride hailing company soared to $5.24 billion. That's just last quarter. That means the last 3 months. Largely owing to stock-based compensation. Here's how the numbers stacked up. How does this company not rolling in the dough? It's a freaking app. It's a glorified kiosk for kids on college campuses looking for a ride. Hey, anybody going to Cleveland? Yeah, I'm going to Cleveland. Want to split the cost of gas? They don't employ the, I don't know, 90% of the people who do the actual work. They don't employ the drivers. I have nothing against the gig economy. I think it's great. Gives people a lot of flexibility and freedom. But how many people do you have on staff that you're losing that? I don't care about the stock compensation. You've never come close to making a profit. You're losing billions upon billions of dollars every quarter. This one just happened to be huge. Fire 80% of your staff. You don't need to redesign your app every 20 minutes. You need somebody to be there to make sure it's working and be able to fix it if it's not. Otherwise, get rid of them. My God. It's insane. I don't understand what their ultimate plan is. It's like the underpants gnomes on South Park. We steal underpants, something, 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 profit. Well, you got to kind of have a plan. You can't just spend like a drunken sailor. Seems to be what Uber is doing. A lot of people are getting rich. And I don't know why people keep throwing good money after bad at it. All right, let's talk about Crazy Uncle Joe. Crazy Uncle Joe, Sniffy Joe. Breck? Is that Breck or is that Head and Shoulders? He's out on the campaign trail and he's not really making a convincing case for himself. It's a little bit sad. It was a little bit sad watching Robert Mueller testify. Watching somebody decline is always sad. Watching an animal decline is sad. Watching a plant die isn't exactly a walk in the park. But watching Joe Biden over these past few months since he's been running for president really is like watching somebody on the decline, lose it, just a little bit at a time. The gaffes, the wrong words, and not catching. Look, everybody uses the wrong words. I use the wrong word all the time. I'm sitting here riffing off the top of my head. And I am bound to say something incorrectly, but I catch myself generally and correct it almost immediately. So there's no ambiguity, no confusion. When you stop catching yourself, when you're saying the wrong things or changing what question you're answering in the middle of an answer in a nationally televised debate, Joe Biden changed the topic in the middle of an answer in the first debate about health care. He was talking about prescription drug prices, then he was talking about health insurance, and he was talking about prescription drug CEOs in particular, and he was then accusing health insurance companies. See, they aren't the same. And he didn't catch it, but he finished the answer with the wrong premise in his head. That's a sign of confusion. I don't say this to mock Joe much. I'm saying this because somebody's got to say it. Somebody's got to tell Joe. Nobody's going to tell Joe. Nobody on Joe's campaign is going to tell Joe. I guarantee you that. They will talk to the other campaigns behind the scenes about, hey, you know, if you guys end up getting the nomination, would you consider taking me over? They're not going to jump ship now. They're making good money. I guarantee you they're making good money. It's a lot of work, a lot of spin afterwards trying to explain these things, but it's the writing. Well, the writing's not yet on the wall, perhaps, but there's certainly the artist who's going to write it has an outline of how they're going to write it on the wall in their head, and they're getting the lid off the paint can. Listen, there are a couple of things. One thing I haven't found audio for yet, but it has been widely reported by liberal journalists, so I would assume that it's true, because they would lie to protect Joe Biden. Today, Joe Biden referred to Theresa May, the former British Prime Minister, as Margaret Thatcher again, and he didn't catch it. I get how that can happen, but I don't get how you don't catch it. I don't get how you don't realize what you just said. I get how you can say things without realizing you're saying things or thinking, having thought it through. But once it's out of your mouth, it goes in your ears. And then your brain reprocesses it and you go, oh, crap, that was wrong. And you correct it. It didn't happen with Joe tonight. But that wasn't the worst of it. Now, Joe Biden's always been a gaffe machine. He's always been kind of a goofy guy. Nobody's ever accused him of being a genius except for him. I'm kind of surprised that he didn't, because he gives himself nicknames all the time. They call me Middle Class Joe. No, they don't. They call me Lunch Bucket Joe. No, they don't. Those are stupid nicknames. Nobody would ever call anybody that. And he tries to portray the middle class Joe thing as, those senators called me middle class Joe and they meant it as an insult. Is that really what we're supposed to believe the United States Senate is? Do senators who have a disagreement meet at the monkey bars after school to fight it out? Is that where we are? Do senators employ the arm rubber, your glue, whatever you say bounces off me and sticks to you defense? No. Joe, and they don't call you middle class Joe as some kind of insult. And if they did, name them. Let's have their names. I want to know who these charlatans are. Let's have their names, Joe. It's kind of weird that nobody ever bothered to ask Joe Biden that until you realize he's a Democrat. But if I'm a reporter on Capitol Hill or on the campaign trail and say, hey, you claim senators called you middle class Joe as some kind of weird insult, making fun of your middle class roots. Who was that? How many of them was it? When was it? That'd be an interesting, I think, question, considering all they ask him now is, will you say the president is a white supremacist? Will you please say the president is a white supremacist? Mr. Senator Biden, I have a question about your health plan. Will you, for my health, say that the president is a white supremacist? It's really that bad. Anyway, Joe Biden has two big embarrassing gaffes today. One where he's talking about poor kids and how they're just as smart as white kids. Like, there are poor white people, Joe. There are, you know, not everybody. Black is not equivalent to poor. But when you're, you know, got a history of rolling with segregationists, what the hell do I know? I've never been a Democrat, so I don't know. The other one is, we're interested in the party of facts over truth. What? Again, not making any of this up. Not totally I guess I got to throw the qualifier in there. Not totally saying this to mock Joe, but I've told you that the end of Joe Biden will come about from his own friends in his own little cabal of leftists, and it will come in a thousand cuts. Nobody wants to come up and really just lay Joe out and take him out of the race because, in at least in a Democratic primary, being negative is seen as being so mean and they want positivity. I mean, how else would you explain the fact that Marianne Williamson exists, let alone will make the next round of debates? So the negative attacks won't really work all that well in the Democratic primary. So they can't be seen, don't want to be seen as the person who lays out the death blow. So they're all going in for their little pound of flesh. 1,000 paper cuts will take out Joe Biden. The problem is Joe Biden runs a pulp factory. He keeps making his enemies paper with these gaffes on top of his flip-flops. First, we'll do Joe Biden talking about truth and facts. Again, anybody could make this mistake, that he doesn't catch the mistake and correct the mistake and do what a normal human being would likely do in that situation when they're speaking to a crowd at the Iowa State Fair. You say, you make a joke about yourself. You make a little self-deprecating joke to cover up for your screw-up, and it's actually a good strategy. It endears yourself to the crowd. Unfortunately for Democrats, fortunately for America, there aren't really any Democrats who are funny, and certainly none who are quick enough to think of something self-deprecating to be able to blow over the gaffe. Joe just makes it and keeps plowing on. Kamala Harris would probably just laugh at herself since she's the only one who finds herself funny. Pete Buttigieg would have a contemplative moment and apologize to the crowd for misspeaking and then do 15 minutes on how everybody can possibly misspeak. But in Trump's America, never mind. Pete Buttigieg is even boring when you're trying to make a joke about how boring Pete Buttigieg is. Let's listen to Biden's gaffe.
Division. We choose science over fiction. We choose truth over facts. And so, folks, if you're interested, join me. I could use the help.
Yes, Joe, you could absolutely use the help. We choose truth over facts. And kind of, in a way, if you think about it, which Joe didn't, and this is giving him far too much credit, but he might have accidentally told the truth a little bit there. The Democrats do believe in truth over facts in the sense of they believe in my truth, your truth. It's their truth. There's only one truth. There's the truth, and then there's stuff that isn't true. But they're not interested in facts. They're interested in their truth. Now, if Joe Biden had said, we're the party of our truth, we're not interested in facts, then he wouldn't have had a problem. Then it would have been completely accurate. And if you want to help me, good Lord knows I need the help. Like getting off this stage and then finding a port-a-john and my staffer who carries my Depends. Maybe I'm being a little too harsh on Joe, but the week that these people have put this country through, they deserve any and everything anybody wants to give them. So disgusting. while that was bad, and that he didn't catch it, is indicating, is telling. It lets you know something. It really does, because it's the frequency with which these are happening. They used to be done kind of for a partisan way. He'd cross a line. You know, with they're going to put you all back in chains. He crossed the line. I have no doubt he knew what he was doing when he was saying that. That's why he said it. He was saying it to a predominantly black audience in South Carolina, I think it was. He and Democrats want to scare the hell out of black people into thinking that, man, you vote for us or you're empowering racism. Well, now white supremacy, because racism's out of fashion. They've used it to death. They've run it into the ground. They pounded it into the ground. And now people just ignore it. So they're saying, well, maybe they'll pay attention if we say white supremacy. Plus, it couples nicely with their bogus notion that only white people can be racists. Anyway, Joe knew what he was doing there. And then when he was talking, the famous audio of him talking to the guy from India, or the guy with the Indian accent, or the, I think the guy was from India in 2008. He says, you know, you can't even go into a Dunkin' Donuts or a 7-Eleven in Delaware without a slight Indian accent. I'm not joking. Horribly stupid, dumb, stereotyping people. If he were a Republican, his public life would have been over, but he's crazy old Joe. He got a pass back then. Not getting a pass now so much. But it would ruin a mere mortal like you or me. But Joe Biden gets to skate. Now Joe Biden won't get to skate. I expect these things to not be widely reported. Again, nobody wants to be the news organization that goes after and damages Joe Biden. There's a third of the party who are convinced that he's the only one who can beat Donald Trump. And you can't alienate a third of your party, at least not this early. So he'll get a pass largely on these. They'll be reported and then they'll quickly move on. What was worse than that one? And again, imagine it doesn't even have to be Donald Trump. If it had been any Republican anywhere who said what Joe Biden is about, you're about to hear Joe Biden say, it's over. They'd be packing up their locker. They'd be shuffling on out to their Uber, provided Uber doesn't go out of business by then, and just going off in shame. They would be ruined. The media would demand their scalp and the scalp of their firstborn. This would be deemed racist. Everything, a Republican sneezes, it's deemed racist. But this definitely would have been deemed racist if anybody but a Democrat, particularly Joe Biden, had said it. Listen.
One thing we should do is we should challenge these students. We should challenge students in these schools to have advanced placement programs in these schools. We have this notion that somehow if you're poor, you cannot do it. Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids. Wealthy kids, black kids, Asian kids. No, I really mean it, but think how we think about it.
Poor kids are just as bright as white kids. He kind of caught himself there because then he says, wealthy kids, black kids, Asian kids, well, whatever kind of kids you got, I'll take your kids. As long as I can smell their hair, I'll take your kids. That would be it. It would be over if any Republican said that. Donald Trump says something like that, even so obviously by accident, it's over. Joe Biden will just roll along. Joe Biden will get along. Joe Biden, it'll just happen because that's the way it works. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, to see how they don't want to pile on. They're going to let everybody take their turn to get their paper cut on Joe. Maggie Haberman is a reporter for the New York Times. She, I think, knows some people who work at the New York Times, I would guess. She tweeted out, Biden says poor kids are just as smart as white kids in Iowa. And she tweeted a story to it from Bloomberg. And she writes for the New York Times. She's able to email anybody who writes for the New York Times. Why isn't this a New York Times story? Maybe it's just not their turn. But believe me, it's coming. It's absolutely coming. Couple more stories for you. Look, in the wake of the shootings last Saturday, you realize there are a lot of evil people in the world, but then in the aftermath, you realize there are a lot of incredibly stupid people in the world as well. And this is a story about them. This is from CBS News, Port St. Lucie, Florida. Just days after two mass shootings stunned our nation, a man walked into a Port St. Lucie Walmart asking for a gun that would kill 200 people. Police said Thursday they had identified the man who made the statement and determined he's actually no threat, rather an anti-gun activist. Quote, they made contact with him at his residence. They have determined him not to be a credible threat to anybody, announced Port St. Lucie Assistant Police Chief Richard Del Toro. He did confirm he is anti-gun, and he is trying to further his platform. You think it's a good idea?
I want to draw attention to this, so I'm going to go to Walmart and say I want a gun that can kill 200 people to make some kind of anti-gun statement. What anti-gun statement? What is the thought process here? I'm genuinely confused. At some point in this man's head, as the desperate hamster running in the wheel in his head is trying to keep the lights on, just not quite able, everything's just dimmed and getting dimmer. But somewhere up there he thought, well, this will, if I go in there and say that I want a gun that'll kill a bunch of people and I walk out with an armload of guns, I can show how easily this happens. And people get away with it. And then it's, of course, it's the gun, it's the seller's fault, it's the gun's fault. The lengths to which liberals will go to absolve the actual guilty party to a shooting is shocking. It's the gun's fault, it's society's fault, it's Trump's fault, it's your fault. What about the dude who did the shooting? Nope. No. Nobody can resist the siren call of an inanimate object. You can't beat that. Yeah, stupid. Of course it happens in Florida. That's the nation's uvula. Nobody knows why it's there. It doesn't do anybody any good. If we could saw it off and set it adrift, the country would be about 38.7% smarter, I would guess. And then there's this story. In the wake of Joaquin Castro trying to putting out a hit list of donors. By the way, yesterday, I forget who it was, whoever emailed me and told me this, thank you. The Department of Corrections would like to issue the following correction. I incorrectly said yesterday that Joaquin Castro had deleted his tweet. I couldn't find it, but I've heard that it is still out there. So he's even worse than I thought. He put out the hit list of, these are the people who are my constituents. I've never heard of a politician attacking by name their constituents. But that's what you get with Democrats. First time for everything. Well, after that, of course, it kept going. This story from Fox 17 in Western Michigan, Grand Rapids to be exact. The reputation of a local restaurant chain is getting political after public records of its donations to President Donald Trump surfaced on Reddit. I love it how it just surfaced. It just bubbled up. The internet belched it out. No, liberal activists went and found it. There are probably going to be more of these. They want to spread it on these websites in the hopes that maybe somebody will decide to go out and protest or burn it down or who knows what. They want plausible deniability, but they definitely want it out there. They want something to plausibly deny. Anna's House has 8 locations across the state of Michigan with signs advertising voted number one best breakfast in Michigan. But now hundreds of Facebook and Reddit users are posting they will no longer be eating at Anna's House after seeing an FEC commission filing detailing its political contributions. According to the FEC, Anna's House Corporate LLC has made 2 $2,800 donations to President Trump's reelection campaign. One contribution is for the primary election, the other is for the general election. Anna's House also listed $15,000 to Trump Victory, a joint fundraising committee. All 3 contributions are dated April 2nd, 2019. And now you've got hundreds of people on Facebook and Reddit saying they'll never eat there again. I would say 4 probably have and ever, you know, did at all or even have heard of it. Because you can post online for anywhere. That's why online petitions are absolutely pointless and worthless. But it's another example of the left. They will come after you. They want to destroy you. If they find out who you are, if they find out you're not one of them, but you're one of them, they will come after you. They'll come after you like that new movie, The Hunt. You know about this, all the controversy about this movie, The Hunt, where the 1% attack people. And there's apparently some line in one of the scripts that says that I love hunting deplorables or something like that. So nobody actually even knows if that's in the movie. It looks like your typical kind of movie. How many times, especially seemingly in the 70s, there are a whole bunch of movies about hunting human beings, rich people hunting human beings. I might tick off a few of you with this one, but I don't see this as a big, massive controversy. It's stupid. It's dumb. But I don't think that this is anything to get really all that worked up. Maybe you don't want to run commercials for it right now on TV, considering the news of the past week. But in general, the anger over this strikes me as more clickbaity than anything else, to be perfectly honest with you. You can get people pissed off about anything, and they'll rage share things. And the more stuff that's shared on social media, the more clicks you get, the more money you make, so on and so forth. And that's why you end up getting all these clickbaity things where the stories don't necessarily deliver if you think about it. I've heard many analysis from the right on this. One is that this is horrible and awful, as I've already covered. Another one is that, you know, the deplorables are the, because the hunted always wins. That's just how it works. Otherwise, it's a horrible movie about people just killing people. The people who are doing the hunting, who are doing the evil, always get their comeuppance in the movies, because nobody would go see it otherwise, except for weirdos who never leave their house. So the deplorables would win. So that makes me think that since this was made in Hollywood, that's not really what you've heard about this movie is not capturing what the movie's really about. I suspect, because there's somebody who was saying, well, the deplorables, the conservatives, the Trump voters, they're the ones who ultimately win. They fight back against the 1%, the rich liberal elite. Yeah, that would be one way it could go, but this is Hollywood. Do you think that movie's getting made? Do you really think that movie's getting made? I don't buy for a second that movie would ever get a dime of funding from anybody in Hollywood. That'd be the last movie they ever produced and got released. What's more likely is if the deplorable line is in there, it was allegedly, as I said, in an earlier script. If it's in there, it's in passing. And, you know, you hear it and you think that about what Hillary Clinton said. But I bet you the liberals don't really spend a lot of time. The liberal screenwriters don't really spend a lot of time thinking about that and being angry about it the way conservatives are, because the liberals probably, A, agreed with it, and B, never considered it a slight against them and their friends and family, whereas the exact opposite is true for conservatives. So what's more likely is this is your typical Hollywood liberal crap movie, where the 1% are these snobby, gun-nut, conservative, rich people who just look down their noses at anybody else who really works hard for a living. That's what I would suspect. That's the movie I know Hollywood would make. That's just me. I could be wrong. You can have your own interpretation. But since nobody's seen the movie, mine just seems more plausible, because the other alternative is that Hollywood was making a movie where Trump voters were the heroes ultimately. That ain't ever going to happen, ever. Anyway, that is all the time we have. We run out of it so quickly on Fridays, which means I actually kind of get to bed. I've been doing a lot of fill-in work this week, Monday through Wednesday, I had to get up at 6:30 after going to bed between 3 and 3:30, recording this and posting it. So that kind of sucked, and I had to wake the kids up then. I can adjust. Problem is, now I'm doing afternoons. Well, I did afternoon yesterday. I'm doing afternoons today. I can sleep in, but since I had to wake the kids up and take them with me to my wife's work where I was doing the fill-in, they've gotten used to waking up early, where they used to sleep till 10. Now they're up at like 7:30 or 8. And that sucks, because I could sleep until 9 and come down and get some work done before they wake up. No rest for the wicked, ladies and gentlemen. And I remain your wicked host. Thank you for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. We've got the Liz Wheeler interview coming up right now.
Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast, the Friday video edition. And as we do every week, we drag somebody from their life into ours so we can pick their brain, find out what they're up to. This week is no exception. We've got an author and a TV star, a journalist, You know, we're on OAN, One America News Network. It is Liz Wheeler. Her new book is out this past Tuesday.
That's right.
Tipping Points, How to Topple the Left's House of Cards, available now. You'll find out how you can win a signed copy later on. Ooh. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Thank you so
much. I'm
going to
sign them, but it's signed by me, but
I mean, that makes it more valuable. It's a scarcer commodity.
Not
then.
Really.
You know what? My favorite part of the introduction, it's still so surreal hearing you say author of a book.
Author.
Yeah.
How you Amazon had you listed as something else. You were involved in some kind of book before.
Yeah. During college, I, you know, got together a group of 14 young conservatives around the country. Because, you know, the Republican Party is so abysmal at messaging to the youth.
They're terrible at it. They're terrible. Forget youth, anybody.
Yeah, but more youth than anything else, perhaps. And so I said, listen, let's not try to, like, talk in big picture here. Let's not talk about, you know, Republican policy wonkiness. Let's just tell people why we as young conservatives are conservative. So we each wrote, like, it was basically a vignette, an essay. Mm-hmm. I was on Amazon as a co-author, but we self-published it. It was a great project. I'm proud of it, but this
you're more
is
ambitious
real.
Than most people in college. You're more ambitious than I am now, still. But Tipping Points.
Yes.
That's the name of your show as well. It's
on Tipping Points,
9 p.m.
singular, yeah.
9 p.m. on OAN weekdays.
Yes.
How do you get to that point? Where do you grow up? What made you want to be on TV and in TV news? And why? What's wrong with you? Did therapy not fix that? Who would want to go into this business voluntarily?
Listen, what I always tell people is, you know, sitting here, all this lipstick and hairspray underneath, I'm really just a huge
tell
nerd.
Tell me about it. Me too. Right under all of this lipstick and hairspray.
No, but really, I mean, I spent my childhood reading books constantly. Huge nerd. High school reading books. I originally, actually, career-wise, I wanted to be a speechwriter.
Really?
A speechwriter for politicians. But I got to a certain point that I would write things and I'd be like, you know, if I want the politicians to say this in the way that I wrote it, I'm going to probably have to say this myself.
Did you actually do that for anybody?
No, I hadn't gotten there.
You were ghostwriting potential speeches for politicians.
Yeah, it was,
okay,
it was
you
kind
are
of just
nerd.
Like the...
okay, I just wanted to clarify for the record.
No,
the,
it kind of became clear, actually, about the speechwriting late in college. I majored in political science, and there was a speechwriting course, and we not only studied speeches, we wrote speeches. And I didn't even like when they were edited, not in the editorial sense, but I didn't like when the message was changed. And I was like, okay, I see how that works. And I knew I didn't want to get in politics. So how else do you get your own message out there if you're not in politics, but your message is political?
I was a press secretary in the Senate for a year. And I know exactly what you're talking about. You write this speech and you think it's great. And the chief of staff says, take this out, put this in, do this. This joke shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And
I'm
like, come on, nobody's going to remember this
dry
speech about
rural
broadband. Nobody cares. Trying to wake people up. So I know what you're saying. You know,
yeah.
I only did it for 1 year. But now you get the beauty of your job and the beauty of what I do is you get to do all of those things. You get to say all of those things, but you're not doing it through somebody else's mouth.
Yeah.
When you write a speech for somebody, you have to think, okay, what is this person trying to convey? What is their voice?
Yeah.
You can't use words that they wouldn't normally use. So you get to do it all by yourself. Yeah. Where do you get your start in television?
Well, my start in television is kind of a funny story. So I've been working at One America News for 4 years. Before that, politics, you know, I wanted to be full-time in politics, but my boyfriend at the time, now my husband, was stationed in San Diego. So I wasn't, you know, really interested in a job in Washington.
The central hub of political activity in the country.
Exactly.
San Diego, California.
Nobody even knows how many branches of government.
But you know what? I haven't been there since I was 12. It's 70 and sunny.
It's perfect.
That.
That's literally the only reason California is still a thing is because it's perfect weather. Otherwise, everyone would leave because of the government. But my husband actually, you know, suggested that I get into broadcast journalism. And so I reached out to the CEO of One America News, Robert Herring. I sent him an email, introduced myself, didn't hear anything back, obviously. I remember telling, like,
what was your job when you're emailing the CEO?
I think what that's was a my very job at the time?
Yes.
Oh, I worked for a veteran advocacy company. I helped veterans.
So you just randomly emailed this guy and okay.
Yeah, introduced myself and of course never heard back. I remember telling my husband like this was the dumbest idea ever. then randomly, I think it was 2 or 3 months later, it was early Sunday morning. Like earlier than I'm usually even awake on Sunday morning, and I get an email in my inbox that literally says it's from Robert Herring, CEO of One America News that says, hi, call me. I think I have a show for you. I wait until an appropriate hour. I was like, I can't call him back at 8 a.m., right?
What if he just sent it? I guess you could.
I don't remember what time he sent it.
That still would have been weird. I called him.
He said, hey, can you come in tomorrow to interview? And I did. He offered me the job, and I started the next Monday on air.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So it was like...
We talked before this about how nervous you were when this book is coming out.
I am nervous. I'm afraid nobody's going to buy it.
How do you handle going, okay, in a week, you've got a television show, yeah. an hour where yeah. it's not you're part of a panel. It's not you're on The Real World. It is Liz Wheeler sitting at a desk monologuing and interviewing people. How were those nerves?
Okay, so I don't have camera nerves, fortunately. That's sort of a natural thing, I think. But let me just tell you, I can't say – that it's not that I'm not proud of those first months. I don't want to say that, but the first couple months, like, I was so bad. It is painful. And I don't say this as a way,
time.
Like, I don't want people to go look up those old episodes.
Everybody's rushing to their computer.
I'm sure they are. Well, enjoy yourself. It's quite a show. I was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. I had not been, even though I didn't have camera fright, I also didn't like know the camera. I didn't know how that worked. So right. I was very robotic, very, very new to it. And you know, the executives at One America were very encouraging. They were like, we know you have this in you, learn how to do this and you're going to be awesome. And so, you know, I did trial by fire.
How long have you been on the air?
4 years.
Four
yeah. Almost
years.
1,000 episodes.
1,000 episodes. Mm-hmm. Good Lord. And now you've gone back into print. Is writing mm-hmm. your first love? Do you love writing more, or do you just like the off the
cuff?
Writing
and talking, that's like...
I know that, but they're very different. Writing is you're sitting alone, right? Yeah. Talking is there's immediate feedback.
Yeah.
That's what makes this so nerve-wracking for you.
Okay, thank you.
I went through this...
Thank you for trying to make me more nervous.
No. It's good nerves because you have these thoughts and you put them out yeah. there and you talk... And you get immediate reaction on your show. Yeah. Somebody can tweet at you. Right. Somebody can email you and say, hey, you're right, or I agree with you, or you're wrong, and here's why. This is like giving birth.
That's what it feels like, kind of. I mean, I wouldn't know, but that's it definitely feels more vulnerable than talking, which is weird. Because in this day and age, especially when we talk on air, like it's there forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, the internet is forever. It's yeah. not like what I tweet goes away. It's not like what I say on my show.
And even if you delete it, somebody screen
yeah,
captured it
archived.
To remind you of your
and
misspellings.
So theoretically, like logically, I guess, a book is no different than that. But for some reason, it feels like it has more permanence than
it is. I tell you, I write 3 op-eds a week.
Yeah.
And a book is completely different because, yeah, there are pieces all over the internet that your kids in the future can go and look up. And it's like, oh, that's neat. This is something more tangible.
Yeah.
So what made you want
to write
a book?
Speaking of tangible, before I answer your question, the first day that I got my box of books from yeah. the publisher, I literally carried it around. Like, I carried it from my office up to the studio. I was like, this is like my pet or something.
I don't take a lot of pictures of things around the house and tweet them out, but I took pictures of my book. Like, this was it. Mm-hmm. You know, I never thought I would ever read a book, let alone write a book. And here was one that I'd actually
yeah.
written. And I know because we exchanged a lot of direct messages during the process.
We did, yeah.
You wrote this book, not mm-hmm. one of those people who are like, here's a piece of my advance. Go ahead and write this for
yeah.
me. You did the research. You did
blood,
the writing.
Blood, sweat, and tears. Like, I'm proud to say I wrote every single word in this book.
Why did you want to tell the story?
Why did I want to write this book?
Yes.
That's a great question. I get so many emails every day after my show that say people tell me, like, I hear what you're saying. I agree with your values. Like, I see what the left is doing and it scares me too, but I don't serve in politics. I don't serve in government. And what do I do as an everyday American? What can I do to help fight this
yeah,
fight?
I know those.
And I obviously answer as many of those emails as I can, but this book is my long form answer. This book is the handbook that I am giving to everybody who's ever emailed me to equip yourself, to be deputized, to be part of this fight. And it doesn't mean that you have to run for president. It doesn't mean that you have to, you know, host your own podcast or host your own show. But this is what you can do, whether it's a debate on your college campus, whether you're talking to your uncle at Thanksgiving, whether you're just thinking about it in your own mind and kind of self-debating these different ideologies and values. This is what you can use to not only understand what the left is doing and why, but to actually have a concrete way to defeat them. I don't think there's anything else like this. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I don't know if there's another conservative book that actually will equip people to do what my book will do.
Well, before we get into the pages and the chapters and the ideas, why are you a conservative? How did you come to conservative politics? Yeah. I understand being interested in the news, but there comes a fork in the road.
Yeah, definitely.
Why did you turn right?
There's a fork in the road, too. I think I was raised in a conservative Catholic household, so part of it is inherent. But even that, there comes a fork in the road where as adults, you have to make a decision, you know, what you want to do. That happens for religious people when you sort of take that leap from your parents' religion to, you know, whether you want to continue to practice as an adult or whether you want to leave that. The same is true for politics. So I was raised in a conservative household. My dad's a small business owner. You know, he would be very open with us, his children, about the finances of his business. So we'd see the impact that taxes and regulation would have on his livelihood, and to see that and to see how that would hurt his business for no reason other than government thought they knew better than him. That kind of ingrains in you a natural conservatism, I think. That was part of my childhood. And then you get to a point as a teenager and as an adult, as a young adult especially, where I just kind of realized, I was like, listen, I do not like when people tell me what to do. Like, I want to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be controlled by somebody else who thinks they know best for me. Even if that means I make mistakes, even if that means that sometimes, you know, choices I make are errors, I don't want a government bureaucrat.
Are you able to take advice, though?
Yeah, I can take advice if somebody's right.
But it's one thing to seek advice. It's another thing for somebody 3,000 miles from San Diego to tell you this is how
it's
you have to live
advice
your life.
When it's like a dictate.
No, it's do it this way or go to jail is pretty much
exactly.
How the government
that's a
works.
Dictate. Advice is different. Advice is saying, hey, here's my experience in the same situation that you're in. This is what I would recommend. And then the person, the individual, has the choice to take it or leave it. That's freedom. What the left wants is the left wants to tell you, hey, we think this is better for you, so you have to do it or else you're going to be penalized by the law. There's no choice in that. There's no freedom.
Now we go inside the book. Now comes the quiz.
Is this
time.
Like the page number quiz part?
No. That's not until later, and then the points double. Let's talk about the first part, because it's organized into different parts. The first part is the five tipping points. This is the laying out of the book. I assume this is the main themes that you get from your audience when you hear from them. Talk about them.
Yeah. So the five tipping points are the five battlefronts. We all know that the left is trying to undermine, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the values on which our nation was built. And they're trying instead to impose a radical leftist ideology, right? Mm. I think conservatives across the board believe that. So the five tipping points are the five areas or the five battlefronts where the left is trying to wage this fight. They are trying to damage things that exist in our country in order to replace those things with their ideology. So some of the five tipping points would be the state of California is something that I talk about because you rolled your eyes.
No, I know. Exactly, I was promised as a kid that was going into the ocean.
I know,
just
and this is exactly why
yet.
I included it in my book, because so often people roll their eyes and discount California as the land of fruits and nuts.
Yes.
And it is.
It is.
But all of the radical leftist policies that we see in California, it is the petri dish.
Oh, I know.
It starts there.
Stupidity
and it's
spreads
disseminated.
Like a cold on a plane.
Exactly.
Either from California or New York.
Exactly. And if we don't pay attention to what's happening in California, I say in my book, what we need to do is we need to hit the mute button on the Democrats' rhetoric and look at their actions. I mean, actions speak louder than words. Everyone knows that. And if you look at the actions of the Democrats in California, that's what they want the rest of our country to look like. That is one of the ways that they are trying to undermine our nation.
Well, they're trying to change fundamentally. Barack Obama was wide open about it in his 3 days before the election in 2008. We're 3 days away from fundamentally transforming this country. If you walked in home and you talked to your husband, said, I love you, honey, but I want to fundamentally transform you. I don't think that would go over very well, but we're told that the left loves America just like we do.
He's perfect. I wouldn't change a thing.
Well, maybe a shoe choice. No, I'm just kidding. But that sort of mentality, you don't fundamentally transform something you genuinely care about. Yet they are very good at messaging. Mm-hmm. They are very good at telling you up is down, that left is right, mm-hmm. that what is isn't, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Conservatives, Republicans are terrible. You get somebody to tell you the time, and it'll take them 15 minutes, and they'll cite three different studies.
Let me explain to you how Greenwich Mean Time influences us here.
From a conceptual standpoint, who's to really say what time it is ever? Do you know how we got so bad at that?
Yes, because we are smarter than the left. And here's what I mean. I'm talking about actual like wonkiness. When Republicans think about a problem, we think about it not in a very, not in a simplistic way. Most problems, unfortunately, aren't a binary option right. That's very obvious. And so Republicans dig into this stuff. They get into the details. They get into the weeds because that's what we have to do from a policy standpoint. But when you try to explain that policy standpoint to the people, it's not exactly scintillating. No. It's not interesting. So Democrats don't get into the weeds. They just promise what people want to hear and then they impose their agenda. So it's kind of an unfortunate symptom of the fact that we're nerdier and we're right.
I remember Paul Ryan's response to the State of the Union when he was just a member of Congress and he had PowerPoint slides or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, charts and graphs. Like, this is great. They're going to trot out a crying grandmother. They say he has to eat cat food because you can't afford her prescription drugs and you're going to lose. It doesn't matter how many facts you have on your side. The left appeals to emotion constantly. And how do you override that when you're telling people to get involved? How do you override the emotion? Because emotion is the most, the most powerful human emotion is emotion, which
it's
is a really stupid thing
tool
to say, but it's
in
the most
human nature,
motivator.
Sure. Yeah,
and it's
definitely
easy to manipulate people. Well, so how do you overcome that?
Well, you harness emotion for good, for one thing. You know, it's not some rule that the Republican Party cannot use emotion. You just shouldn't exploit emotion. You shouldn't use it for evil. You should use it for good. I mean, I actually talk about some tactics how to counter the left's use of emotion and among other dishonest rhetoric that they use. But one of the ways is like actually communicating to people how liberal policies negatively impact them. And conservatives, I think, make a mistake in saying, well, if people only care about themselves, that's selfish. It's not selfish. It's self-interest. And self-interest is a part of self-preservation. So if someone doesn't think a political policy impacts them, seriously, why would they care about it?
It's true. But you can lay out all the logical reasons to ignore emotion. And the crying grandmother wins the day, especially. But
right,
what happens,
but you can do that back. You can say, okay, the crying grandmother is the emotional symbol of the left when it comes to healthcare. And you can do the same thing. You can say, picture a little child with cystic fibrosis who's denied medication, life-saving medication, because the government refuses to pay for that. That's not a hypothetical situation. That is happening as we speak in the UK because the Britain's National Health Service denies that medication on cost grounds alone. Do you want that to happen to your child?
Not
you can
much.
Use emotion in a responsible way.
Well, I've seen it so many times, and this is another problem with Republicans and messaging, is they will look at an issue, no matter how important it is, like healthcare.
Yeah.
And they'll go, that's a Democratic issue. And they'll have two or three talking points and then slowly back away. And if it goes beyond those two or three talking points, they're at a loss. And you end up in a situation where Republicans, not necessarily conservatives, will say, Obamacare is proposed. Here's our version of it.
Yeah.
We've lost the discussion over whether or not it's the business of the government to have that discussion in the first place, to get involved in that. Are we gone from that forever? Are we just ceding? Are we constantly playing defense? Because it seems like all Republicans can hope for, conservatives can hope for, is slowing the decline.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at the people who are in our Congress, and I'm talking about Republicans in Congress, you can see a stark difference between those who are establishment Republicans. They're career politicians. They've chosen Republican because that happens to be the jersey that they chose, versus the public servants who are there to uphold and defend the values as laid out in our Constitution. If you don't have that underpinning of that foundational value and that loyalty to that value, then you are inevitably in the swamp going to just become another politician who doesn't want to piss off their voters, excuse my French, because they want to maintain that seat for the entirety of their career. You're not going to make difficult decisions like cutting spending, for example, if you're trying to keep your seat for the next 50 years, because you're not going to go to people and say, hi, I'm John Smith. I'd like you to vote for me. And my policy is I'd like to take away all your free stuff.
Right.
You're not going to do that.
No, you lose. My problem is when Democrats say, we'll give you a dollar. Vote for us and we'll give you a dollar. And Republicans come out and say, well, we'll give you 50 cents.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, once you accept the concept that the government should give you money, why wouldn't you vote for the person who's going to give you a dollar over the person who's going to give you 50 cents?
Yeah, definitely.
When you're sitting down to write this and doing all the research and going through and you have an idea of what you're going to write to begin with, what surprised you? What did you learn writing this?
that a meticulous outline is invaluable. I wrote this like an OCD person would. Oh yeah. So first I wrote the book proposal. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Put all over,
No, not that far. I mean, I wrote an outline that was so detailed that it helped me completely avoid writer's block because it was so detailed. If I didn't like know what to go to next, it said what to go to next in my outline. And I mean, it was absolutely great. I think I learned just it's just a reinforcement in a sense of what the radical left. And I differentiate that just between the radical left and maybe, you know, liberal voters, because right. most liberal voters actually are not
and
radical
leftists.
They have
leftist. No idea what the Democratic Party
exactly.
actually stands for anymore.
But it really, like, writing some of these stories out really made it hit home what they want our nation to look like. You know, I talk in chapter 2, I think it is, about the left's effort to morph politically correct culture into law. They actually want to codify political correctness. They don't just want it to be like social pressure or cultural pressure. And some of the things that they want to codify are actually terrifying. I mean, I talked last week at the YAF conference, and I talked about that transgender woman who
the one in Canada,
yeah, who's suing estheticians who refuse to wax the male genitalia of this transgender woman. And none of the feminists, you know, none of the My Body, My Choice, Me Too people are standing up and protesting that, even though this man is trying to force a woman to do things to his genitals that she doesn't want to do.
They're too busy trying to get Mario Lopez fired.
Exactly, but none of them are standing up and saying stop because they're okay with that political correctness being codified into law because it's government control and that's their ultimate goal. When you look at how they do this and what they're doing, it really is like – it's almost a punch in the gut because you can convince yourself when you work in politics and in the media that emotions run high, that everything's a little exaggerated. But then you read about their actions. You see – you hit that mute button that I was talking about on their rhetoric. You know, you ignore them saying, we're just trying to be tolerant people. We're just trying to be compassionate people. Yeah. You hit the mute button on that and you see what they're doing. And they're trying to use the law to compel you to violate everything that you believe in, every way that you want to act and even your own body. It's horrifying.
You have section 3 of the book, what they believe and why they're wrong. The what they believe part.
Yeah.
How is – like everybody hears it. You're in media, so you hear it more than this. But when you actually start digging into this, the woman, the thing, whatever, the person in Canada is a shining example. But do people really understand where the modern progressive Democrats are? As much as you pay attention to the news, if you're following on social media, if you catch the nightly newscast – are people getting a full picture of
what
the left is?
Most people don't even believe the stories when you tell them. And I'm not talking about just on my show. I mean, the viewers of my show, I mean, know I tell the truth, obviously. But if you just brought up in a conversation with a friend who isn't as, you know, highly tuned into politics as you or I are, if you brought up some of these stories, they actually say, no, that can't be true. We must be missing some part of the story. That can't be true. And it is true.
The government wouldn't side with that. They wouldn't try and force somebody to do
that. You know, I thought about this from like a sort of a psychological perspective as I was writing that those chapters of this book. I didn't include, you know, my philosophical meanderings in it, but I thought about these lies that are so easily debunked. You know, they talk about this epidemic, for example, of a murders and homicides by assault rifles in our nation. But literally, if you look at the FBI statistics, it's less than 3% of homicides in our nation are committed with rifles. And so-called assault rifles, which we know is a made-up term anyway, but semi-automatic rifles are a subset of rifles. So it is less than 2% of homicides in our nation that are committed with semi-automatic rifles. And I think to myself, you know, are these people stupid? How can you be this stupid when it's so easily debunked? And I think, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, obviously, but from a psychological standpoint, I think when you repeat something to yourself so often, you aren't even, you know, that slimy politician that we all have a stereotype of who knows they're lying and tells it anyway. I think they actually believe what they're saying. And so it's so incumbent on us to make sure that we disrupt that repetition of lying and repeat the truth to people before that repetition of lying is ingrained not just in the politicians but in the voters as well.
Can the House of Cards and the liberal House of Cards, is it in your subtitle, can that be toppled without toppling the media?
No.
They are the megaphone. I mean, they're the fellow travelers. They're on the team. They've got Don Lemon's wearing the D uniform under his suit.
Right. No, I mean, the last chapter of my book is called The Mainstream Media Bias Framework, and it literally lists, I think it's six or seven steps that the mainstream media takes every time they choose to cover a story, and it's the tactics of exactly how they insert their bias into every story. And it's so funny, once you read these different steps, you will see it in every story that's out there. It's why I always call out people in our party, actually. There are people guilty of this in our own party who say, don't pay attention to CNN. Don't give them ratings by talking about them. Don't talk about on Twitter this mainstream media all the time. Just stop making media the scapegoat. And I say to those people, you are so very wrong. Because when the liberal establishment counts on the mainstream media to protect them and to perpetuate their talking points, there is absolutely no way we can defeat the radical left unless we debunk and defeat the bias in the mainstream media as well. They're on the same team. They're part of the same problem.
You had to have gone to events, conventions, things like that, where they're there as well, right? Not that you're hanging out in social clubs and having mixers with them and everything. Working at One America News, you're not going to get any invitations any sooner than I am at the Daily Caller, but you're on television. You're in the same industry as a CNN, as an MSNBC. How do they react to you? How do they treat you? Do they ignore you? Is it polite? Because I've actually found someone like Van Jones to be incredibly polite and nice on a personal level. He's just crazy.
I mean, you'd be surprised at how many direct messages I get from people in the mainstream media who are like trying to be friends with me.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm fine with it. I'm like a nice person. I'm happy to be friends with anybody, even if I don't agree with your ideology. Doesn't mean I'm going to go easier on you if you lie. Right. But I'm fine with that. Like, isn't that how civil discussions
have to happen? Do you get messages from wannabe refugees or people? I got a message the other day from somebody who works at CNN.
Yeah.
Who said, you're absolutely right in this column. I love this point.
Yeah.
And I said, don't tell anybody at CNN. And he said, I know. He knows that he has to – it's a contributor too, not a journalist.
Yeah.
He has to play the game or else he's going to get Jeffrey Lorted out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think when people reach out to you – like I said, I take no – there's no problem with that. Like I welcome that. But I think they listen to what we're saying. They've seen us win. They see us. They saw us won. They saw us win the Kavanaugh battle, and that was like a battle for the ages.
Yeah.
That was the mainstream media more than the Democrats that were waging that battle. And we conservatives, especially conservatives in the media, defeated the liberal media in that sense roundly. I mean, they were squashed, absolutely squashed and humiliated. And so I think what we're doing is working. It's scaring them. They know that there are people that are growing in power, growing, and I'm not talking about political power. I'm talking about influential power. People that are growing in power, they're growing in platform, who are unafraid to call out lies that they tell, and they don't want to be on the receiving end of that. That's a good thing. That should make them more hesitant to engage in dishonest behavior, and that's kind of the point of what we
have. You ever been on the receiving end of a tirade from one of these lunatics?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'm not going to name names because I wouldn't want to call out Jake Tapper. But there have been times when Jake Tapper has sent me a lot of DMs in a row about things that I've tweeted where it's like he was actually wrong about what I was doing in the tweet. But some of them take it so very – I mean, I guess if you're taking incoming fire constantly, you're going to be a little shell-shocked. But I imagine you on television with your clips circulating on social media and the ability of anybody to tag somebody, you got to get under people's skin.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I'm always willing to debate. I always debate civilly. So I think that also scares the left a little bit because they're not going to rattle me into an emotional outburst. I'm not going to challenge someone if I don't have facts behind the challenge. So to respond to it, I welcome it. I wish they would. I'm glad when they do. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's fun to rattle those cages. You know, that's fun.
Oh, it's fun
when they're caught in their lie and you know that, and then more people see your content debunking their lie and saw their lie in the beginning. That's good stuff.
It's a lot of fun, as is the book Tipping Points, How to Topple the Left's House of Cards. Look, this is going to help you communicate with people. This is the thing I get all the time. I know you're right, but what can I do?
Yeah.
This is what you can do.
This is what you can do. It's kind of, I say at the beginning of the book, this is a conservative version of Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. It is a textbook in a sense, not a textbook, a handbook for how to fight the fight as an everyday American. You will find in that book what you need to know to take part in the fight and to win.
Liz, thank you for coming in.
Before
I let you go, I'm going to dump.
What is this?
This is. It's the worst Christmas drawing.
Are you dumping trash on the desk?
Yeah, I am. This is what I did with the book you sent me earlier as I shredded it. No, these are the people.
You can shred it, but you can't defeat it.
Draw two names win a signed copy of Justice on Trial.
Oh, such a good book. And I'm reading it right now, actually.
And in a week or two, somebody will be drawing to win a signed copy of your book.
I do want to praise that book for a second. It's a really good book. Molly Hemingway did a fantastic job with that.
Let's not forget Carrie Severino.
She did a good
job,
too.
It's signed by both of them. It's a super collector's item.
Signed by both of them. Okay, so these are the people that will get a signed copy of that.
Correct.
Do I, close my eyes so I don't cheat?
If you don't know these people.
I don't
I copied and pasted and cut all of these myself. So
okay.
Read it aloud.
But not the email address.
But not the email address. Personal. Don't do a Charlie Hurt.
Jack Blanchard.
Jack Blanchard, congratulations. I'll take this one. And I'll email him later. And then one more.
One more. I don't know if this is one.
That's one.
Okay, who is this? Paget Kidd.
There you go.
You have won a book.
Paget Kidd and Jack Blanchard or whatever, congratulations. You just won a free book. Simon, thank you for coming in.
Of course.
Congratulations on all the success. Go out and buy Tipping Points. And if you want to win
Please
a signed
do.
Copy, email me, Derek at dailycaller.com. If you email a copy of your receipt proving that you've purchased a copy, you get entered twice. So you can get that going.
There you go. Please buy the book. And guys, when you do buy the book, please email me, tweet me, Instagram me. Tell me what you think. I genuinely want to know what you think of the book, and if and when you use these tactics, I want to hear how it goes.
And watch Liz Wheeler every weeknight at 9 on Eastern, then do the math from there on One American News. Otherwise, just go and have a great weekend and be back here on Monday. Thanks for watching or listening. See you later.
Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids.